Good morning. We're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians 7, verses 25 to 40 this morning. So I invite you to either pull out a pew Bible, or if you've brought your own, which we've been really wanting to encourage everybody to do, to maybe bring your own personal Bible to church. And I do want to urge that simply because it's actually better for memory recollection. When you have your own Bible, when you're constantly using the same Bible, you actually remember the passages better. So there is a strategy to this. But if you haven't brought your own Bible, that's okay. There's pew Bibles. We're looking at 1 Corinthians 7, 25 to 40. All right. Starting at verse 25. Now the virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn, as if they did not. Those who are happy, as if they were not. Those who buy something, as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world, as if not engrossed in them. For this world, in its present form, is passing away. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably towards the virgin he is engaged to, and his passions are too strong and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants, he's not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does better. A woman is bound to her husband as long as she lives, but if her husband dies, she's free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. And in my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. This is the word of the Lord. It's no small passage. This one's going to be fun. We are in a series now on 1 Corinthians, and as Ed said last week, Paul is just getting a plethora of questions from this very spiritually immature baby Corinthian church regarding all levels and categories of intimacy, sexuality, sexual immorality, to marry or not to marry, relationship status, etc. This church has a lot of problems. And evidently here, as we've just read, the Corinthians have asked another group of questions, specifically about whether or not those who are currently unmarried or in a betrothal situation should still consider marriage as an appropriate option. And due to the fact that we don't get to discuss this question very often, I'm going to really take advantage of this opportunity, okay? So we're going to go, normally I kind of slodge through the text slowly. We're going to go through it quickly today, okay? So we're just going to blip through it. I'm going to go through it quickly, understand the context, kind of really get a sense of what's Paul really doing here, because he seems all over the place, and focus just on a few spots. But then I'm going to shift to speaking more topically for the rest of the time, okay? Cool? Cool. At the beginning of this passage, Paul asserts his authority in this conversation, stating that his judgment here in this conversation by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. And then he very quickly addresses something that is clearly contextual. He says this, verse 26, because of the present crisis. What is this crisis? That might be kind of helpful. He doesn't say, but it's debatable.
But N.T. Wright notes that various sources at the time point to an empire-wide grain shortage that literally affected the entire Roman Empire. And this occurred between 50 and 55 AD, which is likely the period in which Paul wrote this letter. So he may very well be referring to an economic crisis that's going on, which in the Roman world would have been both very unexpected and very serious. To make any drastic or quick decisions then, such as entering into a marriage and wanting to build a family, in this kind of a season, may not be the wisest choice. But Paul makes it clear, as we read, that there's no sin involved in this, whatever they choose. Verse 27 to 28, are you already engaged? Don't run away from that. Are you not currently engaged? Just stay that way. Paul makes it clear that there's no sin involved here, and as Ed said last week, Paul's simply encouraging them to remain as they are. Don't try to overcomplicate an already complicated situation. He's being very practical here, right? And showing the Corinthian church some pastoral care. Because in his mind, verse 28, those who marry, not to mention in this economic crisis, those in general who marry will face many troubles in this life. And I want to spare you that. Now, that may be a bit jarring for us at first, but why does Paul, does he have something against marriage? It's not that bad, is it? Why is he worried about so many people facing troubles? What does he mean? Well, verse 29, what I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. Huh, okay. So there's something else driving Paul's pastoral theology here. There's something deeper that he's trying to get at. Why is the time short? Are people just dropping like flies because of the grain shortage? Is the Roman Empire cracking down on Christians? Is more persecution coming down the pipes? Well, based on what Paul says next, and really this is his perspective throughout the whole book of Corinthians and in all his letters, it seems that he is entirely focused on Christ's coming back, on Christ's return and the coming of his kingdom, and what that then means for the Corinthian believers now, okay? So he tells them to live in a radical and seemingly almost irrational way. You got a spouse? Pretend as if you don't. Are you mourning? Live as if you're not. Not a big deal. Did you buy something new? Act as if it's not yours. And at first reading, this feels a bit extreme. It almost seems to counteract some of the other things that Paul's been saying, and as if he's calling for a sort of passionless existence where nothing on this earth matters anymore. Is that really, though, how we're supposed to live? Scholars are unanimous here that Paul's using rhetoric or hyperbole in his speech here to make a point, okay? This isn't prescriptive. He's making a point. He's trying to get the Corinthians to set their minds on things above in light of the future reality. So to live on earth as if all of this doesn't matter compared to the glory that is awaiting them. This doesn't mean then that you then neglect what you have or start ignoring your spouse. That's not his point. It means that you hold on to them lightly. You hold them lightly, recognizing what he says at the end of verse 31, that this world, in its present form, is passing away. Notice he doesn't say that the world is passing away as if it's just going to blow up. He says that the current way that the world operates is what is passing away. In other words, the way this world currently operates is not going to be the way that it operates when Christ comes back and returns in his fullness, when heaven touches earth, when the new Jerusalem comes down and the world is completely restored, things are going to look different, is what Paul's trying to say. So as Gordon Fee puts it, Christians are simply not to let this age dictate their existence, their present existence. Paul is pushing for the Corinthians to have the right perspective here on their existence in the world. That's the point. Okay? That is his driving point here. He's pushing for the Corinthians to have the right perspective on their existence in this world. They are not to be absorbed into the world's ways of thinking about things. They are marked out for eternity. So live that way. You're in this world, but not of it. And that must condition how they live their lives now. With that in mind then, verse 32, he wants them to be free of concern. He says, an unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are then divided. And then he says essentially the same thing to women. And before we get too ahead of ourselves here, again, thinking that Paul hates marriage, he cannot think that it's impossible to both have a spouse and serve God. Because consider Priscilla and Aquila, a couple that we see in the book of Acts, who did ministry with Paul, who started the Ephesian church with Paul. Obviously, that's an option. Obviously, that's an option. But it may be that in certain situations, such as an economic crisis in the whole Roman Empire, it may be that in certain situations that it is near impossible to do both well when there are so many other possible life distractions. Because look at what he says in verse 35. I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, not to take away your freedoms, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. Again, he says, if you feel you want to get married because you're currently betrothed or engaged, go ahead. It's okay to get married, but it's also okay for you to not get married. Same to the woman. If the husband dies, she's free to marry in the Lord. But verse 40, in my judgment or opinion, she is happier or better off if she stays as she is. So there's no right and wrong here, okay? There's no absolute right and wrong here. Paul is simply wanting to get the Corinthians to consider the coming kingdom and prioritize service to the Lord. That's the point. But the Corinthians' minds are only thinking about being married or unmarried. Which one's more holy? All the matters in this life. And Paul's trying to get them to expand their brains and pay attention to Christ. Focus their attention on Christ. What does it look like to have unhindered devotion to Christ and his kingdom? He's keeping them in check here, okay? He's keeping them in check. Because the Corinthians, as we've seen, are really extreme. Right? They'll go to either extreme all the time. And he's trying to keep them in balance and reminding them that being married isn't the end-all be-all, nor is it the ultimate and necessary Christian lifestyle. That's not the only option. Which was so radical and so out of the norm for Paul to be pushing this narrative. Because it was expected that people, especially women, got married. As I mentioned a couple weeks ago, the only reason a Jewish man wouldn't marry is if he was going to devote his life to studying the law. That's the only reason they wouldn't get married. Paul likely, of course, was in that camp, although it may actually be true that he was married at a time. We don't know. And that when he came back from Damascus, you know, with his head in a Jesus cloud, his wife said, I don't want any of that, and walked out. That could actually have happened, which may make sense for some of the other things he says. We don't know. Either way here, he's affirming the unmarried life, even going so far as to call it better. And what's more, he's not only opened up that option to men, but to women as well. Both men and women are free to set aside worldly societal norms in order to pursue undivided devotion to Christ and his kingdom. And he has to be careful with these Corinthians, right? Because remember, earlier on, they were wanting to avoid marriage for other distorted spiritual reasons. And so he needs to kind of disaffirm those mistaken ideas, thinking that one's better than the other, and reemphasize that both of these are gifts from God. They are gifts for and from God. So if that's the dominant narrative that Paul is pushing here, that in light of the coming kingdom of Christ, both marriage and celibacy are beautiful gifts from God, how then do we follow suit and affirm singleness or celibacy in the same way that Paul has? I want to spend the rest of the time here talking about this, because it's a much neglected topic of conversation. How can we encourage and teach one another and our children to seriously consider that we have two very appropriate options living as disciples here on earth. And now, just a warning, it may sound like I'm swinging the pendulum from a couple weeks ago when we talked about marriage, but I am for marriage, okay? So before you start thinking, you know, my poor husband, oh, that poor suck, he has to be married to someone who loves celibacy, I am for marriage, okay? But for the sake of the argument this morning, and for the sake of emphasizing the other one, it's going to sound a little bit more one-sided, okay? Good. I also want to just encourage us this morning to be mindful of the water that we're swimming in, okay? This conversation may feel a bit strange, but that's because we've only really ever given marriage as an option. If you never know differently, how would you ever consider it an option for yourself? Okay? All right. I want to argue that we actually do live in a crisis today. It's not the exact same crisis, obviously, as what Corinth was experiencing, but it's the crisis, I think, of a relationally messed up culture. And there are so many reasons why people would choose or not choose to remain unmarried in this societal age. James Houston once said something along these lines, that there is suffering in our culture here because we live in a culture that has forgotten God. And when it has forgotten God, it has forgotten how to love. And when a culture forgets how to love, relationships suffer. How does this then play out? N.T. Wright says this, in the last 100 years or so, what we've seen is the rise of sexuality as an identifying label, a sign of a hidden identity which can be discovered or recognized. But he says this, biblical witness suggests that this is deeply misleading, as is the implication that all humans need active sexual experience in order to be complete and fully alive. This, I would argue, is the result of a relationally messed up culture that has forgotten how to love, because now we're defining love only in terms of sexual experience. Which means then that now there is what we call the shame of singleness, where the sexual ache is not being fulfilled. And the constant questions that someone receives are, hey, anyone special? Have you found someone yet? Did you bring anybody along? When do you think you'll get married? What are you waiting for? Have you tried online dating? As if that's the only way that we can receive love in this world, by having a partner. As if something's always missing and unfulfilled if you don't have that. We're lacking what our overly romantic culture, and we do live in an overly romantic culture. You turn on the radio, 90% of the songs are about somebody else. It just implicitly claims that that's the highest good, that that's what we all need to be working towards and achieving. And frankly, based on how we act in the church, we've simply just continued the narrative, but thrown some Christianese into that. Many churches look at singles as those who haven't yet fulfilled their purpose, as if lives don't really start until you get married. Rachel Held Evans once said this, even as a child, I noticed that church deaconesses hosted dozens of wedding and baby showers each year, but never a housewarming party for a single woman, or a celebration dinner for a woman who passed the bar or graduated from medical school. Subtly, the belief that I was incomplete without a husband and children crept into my subconscious. I believed my contribution to the church as a single woman didn't really count. How did we get here? Because looking through church history, the Catholics always really emphasized the celibate life, going actually too far almost as to call it the more holy option. Well, then what ended up happening was in the Protestant Reformation, that was one of the things that the Protestants really pushed on and said, whoa, no, hold on. Marriage is also good and sacred and points to God. But then what, of course, naturally happens with any good idea is that it also has the capacity to be taken too far. The pendulum swung, and it never really swung back. It never balanced out, never evened out. And what we need now, I believe, is a radical rebalancing of that pendulum. Listen to what Sarah Williams, a church historian, says on this. She speaks about kind of the mixture of ugliness and beauty in the history of the church and how we might need the light of God's Spirit to shine deep within us and challenge what we believe is normative. She says this, "So we, for example, elevate marriage as the quintessential way of being holy in our Protestant tradition. But what about if we had a radical rediscovery of the spirituality of celibacy? What would it be like to call people into a life which isn't singleness, i.e. waiting for the bus of marriage to come along, but is about renunciation, about people giving themselves with singularity to Christ, living lives of prayer, of intentional intimacy with Christ, lives which are not lonely, but lives that must be lived in community? What if we reimagined how we did church so that the nuclear family isn't the idol around which all things have to flow? What if we were a place where that narrative changed? And those who are single or unmarried really felt like they had purpose and felt that they were part of the greater family of God. To see both married and unmarried as gifts from God. Because as it currently stands with us, Paul's words don't really make sense in the way we operate. How would we do this? How would we change this narrative? I have four thoughts on this. For starters, it may need to begin with changing the language that we use. To call someone single kind of implies that they're alone. And it's not a biblical term, actually. It implies, at least to me, that it implies that there's an incompleteness. And that one is just waiting, as Sarah said, for the bus of marriage to come along. If we say unmarried, it right away associates the person with lacking the alternative. You're not married, so then you must be unmarried, i.e. lacking in marriage. So in this case, marriage is the norm, and you then deviate from the norm. So I don't really like that either. Neither are super helpful. And we really just need a better vocabulary in this area to really honor one another and each other's life stages. So for today's purposes, I am going to use the word celibate, which I know sounds archaic, but I think it's actually the best option. Because in the history of the church, they referred to celibacy as a spiritual discipline or vocation. And that's along the lines of what Paul here is encouraging. So we can start there, I think. Secondly, I made the argument 2 weeks ago that marriage was about sanctification, of becoming sharpened and shaped more and more by the Holy Spirit to look like Christ, to be like Christ, to be united with Christ. And the same is true for celibacy. It's about sanctification. Both marriage and celibacy reveal how deeply selfish we all are, and thereby reveal our need to be more like Christ. So both then have the capacity to orient our desires in the right direction and draw us nearer to Him, which is what Paul was trying to articulate to the Corinthians. It's not about your marital status. It's not about you. It's about Him. Because Jesus said that if anyone would follow Him, they would deny themselves and join Him on the road to Calvary. That's the call for us. So a big part of that reorientation towards Him, a big part of sanctification, is self-denial. Voluntarily giving up certain freedoms or pleasures because we're setting our sights on a higher goal. That higher goal is Christ. And in baptism, we've each committed and submitted ourselves, including our bodies and our desires, to Christ. Self-denial is part of that sanctification process, realizing that we're not our own, and that to be His disciples means that we pick up our cross with our broken, frail bodies and carry them to Calvary. Because that's what He did for us. He died for us while we were yet sinners, while we were yet broken, while we were yet lacking and longing and aching. And so in this family, in this church family, this is a place where all of us are on the road to sanctification. We're on the road of sanctification. And so none of us should ever feel shame, and none of us should ever feel alone. Because thirdly, throughout church history, celibacy always implied community. It was never an individual project or a single endeavor that you just do by yourself. Jesus chose to live without a wife, but he never lacked community. He dined with sinners and was called a glutton and a drunkard and kind of seemed to be the life of the party most of the time. Monastics always lived in community. They still do. They live in community because they have to. That's how they show love for one another. That's how they serve one another. Living in a community house during my time studying at Regent made me see this a little bit better. I lived in the manse next to a church in Vancouver. I was studying the monastics. I was learning the contemplative life. I was living in community with six other people. I didn't actually feel a need to be married. Wesley Hill, who is a professor in Pennsylvania and has chosen a life of celibacy, notes that it doesn't have to equate to loneliness and isolation and exclusion from meaningful relationships. He lives with a married couple, friends of his who have two young children. He's a godparent to five other children elsewhere in the world. He's a spiritual uncle to all of them, and his friends have really incorporated him into the family. We have to start thinking outside of the box here. Because maybe our homes could be homes for more than just our own families. Maybe we could invite one another into community living situations. Have we given space for our kids to receive input from unrelated family members, from spiritual mentors or godparents? On a smaller scale, maybe our small groups could intentionally have both married and celibate members. Or do we only ever hang out with people in our own life stage? Is there a place here to redeem a vision of family that is bigger than just our own nuclear families? Because Christ didn't call us, a support group or a yacht club. He called us a family. What does that mean for us? And can we expand our imaginations to think a bit more creatively about this? Fourthly, I want to urge that celibacy does not imply permanency. Regent Professor Diane Stinton felt a call to adopt a little girl after doing her PhD in Kenya. She raised her predominantly on her own and just recently ended up getting married in her early 50s. Her daughter is 14 now, I think. Another woman puts it this way when asked about a call to singleness. Am I called to singleness? She says, today I am. I don't know about tomorrow. Again, live into the reality that Christ has called you to today. Live into that reality. And really, the same goes for marriage. It's not necessarily permanent in this life. My husband, Danny, grew up with a single mom. His dad died when he was only 9 months old from a brain tumor. His mom was married for 6 years, and then she was called to celibacy. Then she was unmarried again. We don't know. Nothing is guaranteed. I wasn't guaranteed to get married. I wasn't guaranteed to stay on my own. I'm not guaranteed to be married to Danny until I'm 95. So why would I live that way with those expectations? Especially when an even greater joy is waiting for both of us. What have we done to ourselves and to our faith and to our understanding of Jesus by limiting ourselves to a vocation that doesn't even exist in the new kingdom? Because relationship will be completely and utterly fulfilled by Christ. Our longings and our aches and our pains that we have inside and outside of marriage will be completely fulfilled in the presence of God. That doesn't mean that we love people less now. It actually means that we love them more. Because my spouse is not my life. My family, my nuclear family, is not my whole existence. The more devoted I am to Jesus, the more devoted I am to the people that he's given me to be in community with. As Paul said, the pressures of this present life are part of an age that is fading away. And Christ has given each of us the freedom to live differently in this world in light of that. So then, and I'll close with this, what does celibacy bring to the table? Those who are celibate for today have a prophetic call, says Paul. They have the opportunity to pursue Christ and remind their married friends that we have not been invited into the life of the triune God to care only about our lives on this earth. That prophetic call was heard by Mother Teresa, which sent her into ministry in Calcutta. That prophetic call is why a third of the missions field is made up of single women. Joanna Veenstra was the first missionary to Nigeria in the early 1900s and fought with the CRC to convince the churches in this denomination that it was actually worth her time. And now the church in Nigeria is flourishing. It's why my mother-in-law and other missionaries are still in Angola, teaching and preaching and doing healthcare, even though their children live elsewhere. It's why Dina, who we're going to be giving a special offering for later, has given her life to pursuing the well-being of refugees coming to Canada. Countless men and women throughout history have contributed to spreading the love of Christ because they chose, at least for a season, to be unhindered in their devotion to Christ. Would they be okay to still get married? Yeah, probably. But that's not their primary objective in this life. Because they were and are men and women whose first priority is to follow the call of Jesus Christ. That's all that matters. And they are rich and unwaveringly faithful disciples because of it. Connolly Gilliam, a staff member at Regent, speaks of her life of unintentional singleness as a life where she was able to discover the depths of God in unforeseen ways. Now in her late 40s, she says this, "If there was someone with whom there was more joy to be together than to be apart, even 50% or 51%, then yeah, I'd still be game to get married. But I've also seen how God has borne so much fruit through my life that I didn't even want to bear. I've been shocked by how God's goodness has continued to sweep into my life." And she says this, "I'm the surprised one." None of us in this life will be free from aches and longings or from feeling alone. None of us are free from that. Our desires are off kilter. Our bodies are broken. We're not as we should be. We're waiting for redemption. And as Richard Hayes puts it, anyone who doesn't recognize that longing doesn't really understand Christianity. We long for him. We long for Christ to return and for the full redemption of our bodies. It's a matter then of taking that longing and training our hearts so that when we do see Jesus face to face, we'll understand. To keep our desires and our longings in tune with him and not forget that we have a future reality. I have a dream. I have a dream that one day we'll see Christians celebrating the desire to be celibate. Not to react and say, "Oh, that's so sad," but to delight in a Christian brother or sister's desire to pursue Christ at all cost. Undivided, unhindered, walking ahead, yes, with open arms, willing to receive whatever God puts or doesn't put in their hands. Marriage or not, whatever God sets before them. Looking ahead, though, with joy to the final restoring of all things. How great would that be? Where the question is never, what do we lack? But rather, how can we best set our hearts on Christ in the place where we are? Because that's exactly where he wants to meet us. Amen.